what to say. This is for you. Is something going to happen? Nothing's happening. No talk. There's lots of talk, but it's in the mind. Is there going to be a talk? Is it going to work? Is he going to shut up for 10 minutes? Is it going to be interesting? Is it not going to be interesting? Can I trust? Or can I worry? In this small moment of thoughts about what will happen, is there trust? Is there concern? Maybe there won't be a talk. I'm just using it as a kind of window that something in us that is frightened of silence or of nothing or of not knowing. And the mind just fills the gap. And it fills the gap with many different directions. But if we look at this thought that was just now, 5 minutes ago, we can also see in this small moment, a kind of window, does my mind tend to go to fear, concern, daga, or to trust? Or is there silence? Or don't I care if there will be a talk or there won't be a talk, or if Stephen opens his mouth or he doesn't open it? Is there something that doesn't care or does care? Just a small window, and the way the mind fills every gap and doesn't like nothing. One of my early biology teachers said, nature hates a vacuum. Nature hates a vacuum. Vacuum. And there's something very right about that. That we all feel pressure. And it's often very subtle. Pressure to be somebody. Pressure to know what's going to happen. Pressure to be safe in knowledge of what will be now, in 5 minutes, or tomorrow. There's something all the time this pressure is saying, life. It's not in, life is got to be lived now, full of thought and action and knowing and information and internet, and there's something about that. And it's not personal. this fear of empty space is not personal. It's karma. And it's every being, every ant, every peacock wants to be, wants to build, wants to have babies, wants to be safe, wants to know what's going on. If I go there, it'll be better. If I go there, it'll be better. In the retreat in the summer, I was joking, I don't know if you were there, but I was joking. We were talking about this kind of thing, and a peacock was walking past, and I was saying, do we know what the peacock is thinking? We say, oh, beautiful peacock, it's so lovely. Maybe the peacock is thinking, oh, I want to be a boring little sparrow. Drawer. Why have I got such a big tail? Why are they all looking at me? Why it's so heavy to be a peacock? Because it's not easy. My life is so difficult. Let me be a sparrow under the bushes, free and boring, no colours. We don't know. So karma makes pressure, and it gives us trouble because we don't notice it. It just makes us act and do and manifest ourselves and do better and go to work and do our life properly and get things right and know what's going to happen tomorrow and so on. But there's something there that even in that is a liberating insight. Because it's one of the first talks of the Buddha, actually, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. He said, if we look carefully at the fact that there's no way we can control thought, that thought is doing its thing, we can't design our stream of consciousness. It does itself. And that shows that we're not in charge. And that shows that there is no self in charge. Because if there was, we could design ourselves. We could design our experience. And we cannot. So that's already liberating. Everything I've said about karma up to now has been a sense of helplessness. Oh, I'm just being pushed around. But there's another side to it, which is an insight that if it's all happening not designed, metuchnan, not designed by me, I can't design my thought, I can't design what will happen, I can't design my future. I can be busy trying to, but it's failure completely. So there's a place there that says, well, the world is bigger than us. And that's already an experience of bigness of things not in my hands. And that puts things in perspective. A thought will come and go like the peacock. But if it's not in my hands, then I don't need to worry about it so much. It's coming from karma. Do I need to worry? Do I need to care? Do I need to change it? Do I need to fix it? Do I need to make it better? Anyway, it's not in my shoulders. So this movement of taking things less personally, including our suffering, is a really important movement. So we're sitting here with our back pain, and it feels very much my back pain, but if you wait a minute, you know, how can it be my back pain if I can't tell my back what to experience? If it was my back pain, I could tell my back what to do, but I cannot. So the back is listening to another voice, not me. So it's not mine in the first place. What are the voices the back is listening to? All the conditions of this moment. Everything, karma, my history, my parents, my DNA, my, the ancestors, the winds, the biology, the tensions that are built in the system. By the way, for those of you who do take it personally, I can tell you that we've had here in retreat people who've been doing yoga 20 years, ballet dancers that are super dancing. Makes no difference. They sit down, shut up, and the back starts to hurt. Never mind, they've been yoga for 20 years. We're not in control of all of this. And there's something beautiful about that. That we sit down, we mind our own business, and all of a sudden karma comes and goes tick, 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 you know. This is happening, this is happening, this is happening. And we think, oh, help. But actually there's something, a great relief in that. Is a major understanding that brings equanimity is just this. That whatever we want from our life, our happiness and our struggle are based on conditions, not on what we want. And one of the, I think Ron mentioned the mantras, phrases that are used in equanimity practice. And one of them is, my happiness or suffering are the result of conditions and how I am with them, and not what I want for myself. My happiness or my suffering are the result of conditions and how I am with them, and not from what I want for myself. I can actually put the equanimity quotes in Hebrew. I'll put them on the board tomorrow. There's two or three of them, the equanimity practice mantras. And so one of the places that we can move in our practice is a place of non-preference. E adifut. If it's really come from karma and conditions, how I am with them wisely in order to find a place of rest, a place of steadiness, a place of being settled, is non-preference. I think, again, Ron was using that phrase before. It is. It's just as it is. One of the most famous one-line Zen statements is, it's actually a long poem, few hundred years ago, but several page poem, but the first line is, enlightenment is easy for those with no preferences. Adifuyot. And this tells us actually that one of the places of practice, very, very basic, is working with the preferences. Vedana. Good for me, not good for me. It's like that's what got us kicked out of Gan Eden, where we ate the apple of Tovli Rali. And we ate it. It's inside. It's not theory. It's right inside. Dovli Rali. And we got us kicked out of there. So we can look at that. Vedana is looking at that. This voice, Dovli Rali, Dovli Rali, knowing it's not ours really, knowing it's coming from conditions that we're not in our control, and feeling the sense that we can be bigger than Dovli Rali. Good for me, not good for me. Pleasant, unpleasant. We can be bigger, we can hold them both. We can allow them both. Because we're not in charge of when is going to be one and when is going to be the other. Conditions are in charge. not us. And Vedana is a very interesting place to practice because it's very immediate. It's before we build story. It's just that moment of, you know, there or there. It happens very fast. We're not even conscious of it a lot of the time. Something pulling us, something pushing us. And then we build a story. Oh, amazing miso soup for supper. The first taste, though, is just lovely. Then comes the story. Wow, what's the recipe? Maya, what's the recipe? I'm a fan of miso soup, as you can see. My preference, miso soup. And it really helps us if we see what gives us suffering. It's not Vedana. It's not that immediately response on the tongue, miso. It's the story we build out of that. And that's a pressure to construct a story all the time. And we can begin to notice that pressure, which is a habit of the karma to say, you know, what's going on? Do you want more of it? It's good. What's the recipe? Take it home. Tell somebody. Wow. When you leave the retreat, I don't know what happened in the retreat, but the miso soup was fantastic. And for that, we need attention. We need to get close. We need to get intimate. And it's the intimacy which does the job here. Intimacy with our experience. Intimacy with really what's happening now. Including what I build, the story I build. Kind of going back to the source of the story and seeing the Vedana that created it. But knowing that the way the karma builds our stories, and it's happening to us, the stories, and we think we're in charge of them and we're not. Attention will show us that. And there's something freeing about all of that. It may seem a bit scary that I have to let go of control, that I really am not in charge of my thoughts. Of course we are in charge. To some extent, I've decided to talk about miso soup, so I'm in charge of the thought miso. But if you look at it more carefully, you see that this moment is created by so many conditions, including what was for supper. A million conditions, and then out comes this response. So, very basic statement. Of Dharma, which is the truth frees us, not the wish to be free. Which is counterintuitive. We think, well, if I really want to be free and get rid of all the problems and so on, then I'll be liberated. The conditions will be right. But it's the truth that frees us. The truth is, what's really happening in this moment? What am I building out of this moment? Where is the source of what's coming up? And what's underneath it all? Which is a fundamental freedom, which is not the story. The story is built out of the karma, but underneath that there's base, there's existence. Karma is the habits of construction. Underneath there is just existence. And that's a place of deep freedom, which we can see through going through. It's like we dive down through under the constructions that we make around life, the stories, and the dramas usually. We dive down, 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 under the karma, if you like, and we meet existence. And it's just being deeply honest Vipassana, the word vipassana does have that in it. Vipassana, V is it's like vision. To see between, and pasana is to see deeply. Vipassana is to see things as they really are, to see the truth of things. They call it insight or tovana. But it's about being very honest about what's happening, including the pain of constructions and the pain of being a whatever's arising. And if we do have preference, I prefer this and this, we see that honestly. And that truth frees us, because otherwise we're all the time running after things in an automatic way. And the truth allows us to stop and say, okay, what's really happening? And let me look a bit more deeply, and let me look under there, and let me be more intimate. And then we find ourselves connected with many, many levels of existence, including what isn't karma, which has no construction, which has no history, which is just being, havaya, which is just being. And this attention that we use, is the way we use attention here, is quite soft and is more female than male. It's like a mother that sees what's going on with a small child that can't speak, maybe a baby. The mother knows exactly what's going on, the baby can't speak. But the mother knows it's this and not that, and what the baby's trying to express. And we're like that. It's maybe not in words, it's maybe deep down, it's intimacy on levels which we go down, 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 or I don't even know down, down, it's not really the right, that's also an image, it can be up, up. I don't know really. But you know what I mean. And there, we'll find places where there's no pressure of karma, there's no pressure of conditions, and those places are really natural. And there's something here that I really want to pass, because there's a tendency to say we're here to practice in order to get states of mind, such as silence or samadhi. And it's fair enough. Even vipassana, a word like this, to practice vipassana, I need 10 days for that, says Goenka. They don't like us too much, because we have only 3 days. But we also have 3 weeks. But it's conditions. It's conditions. There's something which is not about models of practice, but something natural. That if we look at the truth of the moment, it's really such a clear, clean sort of way of looking at practice. It's not a cheder kosher that we're trying to get silence, and every time the mind takes us off and pulls us to what we have to do next week, and we think we failed, and the mind is just busy all the time, and I'm not practicing, and it's just disturbing, and so on. Yes, that's true, that we can feel that. But samadhi isn't measured like that. Samadhi is also an intimacy. It can be in that place of deep, one-pointed concentration, yes. But samadhi is also staying with intimacy, staying right there, lishot, to stay with. The Buddha talked about it, abiding means lishot, to live with, to stay with, like your home. It uses the word, abiding is a word of home. So to be at home in our experience, it doesn't feel then like going to the gym in order to practice a muscle called silence, as opposed to noise. The mind. All of what I'm saying is a different view. The mind doing its thing We can be there, right there with the mind going everywhere. But under that mind going everywhere, there is a beingness, which is really, really natural. And the more we're in a place of non-duality, of non-preference, the more we'll find ourselves in the natural place. The truth is natural. It's not a truth that we invented because the Buddha said it, or because it's not an invented truth. And it's not only the Buddha said these things, of course. You'll find it in Sufis, you'll find it in, non-dual Kashmiri Shaivism of India, you'll find it in, it's everywhere. You'll find it in Bina, in Kabbalah. The truth, which is a female quality of intuitive, natural wisdom that looks deeper and deeper into what's underneath. And it's not an analytic, very sort of pushing process, it's much more allowing, a mothering kind of awareness. So we have to be careful of models of samadhi, of shutting. Samadhi is shutting down the mind. Everything I'm saying is, up to now, is we cannot, because it doesn't belong to us. And so instead of that, allow it, be with it, know it, stay with it. Where is it taking us? What's taking us? And what's the mind that knows the mind? What's the mind that knows thought? And it brings us to a place of a big view, less personal. We are a community, says the Indian poet Kabir. This is a nice poem. We are a community, each one of us. We're already a Sangha, right here. It's not just legs, arms, and eyes, and nose. It's thoughts, impressions. That got the whole world's in us. Think of everything that came into us from the last 30, 40 years. The whole universe is in there. Karma is just keep sort of loading us with everything, with others, and we ourselves are made of so many voices. When we listen, sit quietly, we listen. What we do have is the tendency to say, my mind is disturbing. So that puts the mind there in a kind of a voice of the mind as being a major problem, and we have to fight it. But it's a community. The mind is this, the heart is this, the cells are talking, the blood is talking, the energies are talking, the memory is talking, aggregates, to use, again, Dharma language, mitsarfim. Neurologists will say exactly that. They once put me in a machine, MRI, and it was kind of interesting, although the machine was so noisy that I simply, after that, I said, no, find another machine. And then they put me in another machine called MEG, which is very subtle. It doesn't do anything. It just measures the magnetism coming out of a thought. It doesn't. It's very, very delicate. And it doesn't put anything in like the MRI machine puts in magnetism into your brain. And then it looks. So I was amazed to watch, they asked me to do all kinds of things in the MRI, and then I got loads and loads of pictures, and every different kind of thought was another piece of the brain lit up, and another bit, this was yellow, this was blue, this was yellow, this kind of thought was like that. This, I was watching, like the brain was a kaleidoscope of many, many images. And then we discussed, I said, okay, let's have a period now with no thought and no mental activity. None. And I said, okay, let's do that. That's definitely up my street. I'm happy with that. And the picture came out on the computer. Not a sign, it was like a dead brain. I myself was shocked. Wow, there's not one little bit of yellow in that picture. And they were shocked. They said, even, have we never seen this before? I think it was at Bar-Ilan, I can't remember which. I think it was Bar-Ilan who did it. So when we listen to voices, by it themselves, the voices will be voices of life. They will not be just voices of us. We already had, you know, sense of image of karma coming from all the histories and all the thousands of lifetimes of humans that are thinking certain things. And but also all the voices don't, because they don't belong to us, it's really helps us to go out and then to see that, you know, in a way we belong to the universe. The universe is not just listening to the voices will take us out there. Life will show us. The breath that we breathe is the breath of the trees. We just can sense it. Where's that breath coming from? It's coming from the trees around here. Where's the light coming from? It's coming from the sun. Why do we see the light? Because the eye is built by the sun to see the light. If there wasn't light, there wouldn't be an eye. So the light and the eye are made together. The breath is coming from the trees. We give to the tree. You know, the whole thing is. And it's just a matter of seeing more deeply and seeing without a filter that I am the center of it all. And unfortunately, karma will do it like this to us. Pressure. There's a lovely little poem that I found. Some of you have maybe had flies on your nose or your. So far, I don't know. Little fly, your summer's play, my thoughtless hand, my hand without thinking, has brushed away. Am not I a fly like you? Or are not you a person like me? For I dance and drink and sing till some blind hand shall brush my wing. A sweet poem. We are the same as flies. So if we kind of go to that place, we'll go to a more elemental place. And one of the interesting meditations that are relevant to equanimity is meditation on the elements, where we really do sense that our meditation is like the earth, is endless, is like endless ground or endless air or endless water or endless fire. And there's a sutta which is very relevant, and I'll just read it in English from it's one of the Pali suttas. Develop meditation that is like the earth, for then pleasant and unpleasant contacts with the world through the senses will not invade the mind. Just as people throw clean things and dirty things and shit and urine and spit and blood on the earth, and the earth is not disgusted, but just absorbs it all. And then the same with let your meditation be like water, endless water. Let your meditation be like fire. Let your meditation be like the air. In other words, the elements. A kind of message of all of this is that meditation, in a way, is natural. It may seem like we come to a retreat, we have to give up our usual life, we have to give up our telephones and argue with our partners that say, well, again you're going on retreat, leaving me with all the mess. Whatever. It may seem a bit artificial, but actually it's the most natural thing we can do, which is to see and let go of the pressure to be a certain way, to live in a certain way, to see how it is that we, who is it that is experiencing things, to let go of that pressure that is constructing our life, called our life should be like this and like this, and I have to work and I have to do this and I have to do this. There's a karma in there which we just sort of follow, and it seems really, really natural to stop and say, what is the pressures? What is the story I'm building? What is the ground of that story? Where is that story from? And meditation in that sense is very natural. It's kind of reconnecting to the truth of our life rather than just being run by the story, which is often collective story, community story, or history story, or conditioning story, or whatever. So it's natural, and we always, if we open the truth of things, we always come to a bigger picture. That we and the fly are really not so separate from each other. And because that's the truth of things, it's inviting us. We just stop and look and we'll see that. So it's not artificial what we're doing here. It feels like that because sometimes we need to make the break in order to kind of give us space to do that. So it feels a bit artificial, so it needs a retreat, etc., etc. But by the way, that doesn't last forever. We may seem at the beginning, but then after a while, our home becomes a retreat, and the retreat becomes our home. We don't feel it's artificial at all. The practice just becomes our life. Our life and our practice just join together. So in the beginning, yes, we feel we have to go out of our life in order to come here and practice, but that's just on the way. Slowly, slowly, we become kind of married monks or whatever. Our home becomes our cave, and our cave becomes our home, and the retreat. And by the way, this is a great advert for service retreat. Those of you, will hear about it tomorrow morning a little bit, but the service retreat is a great place to learn that. To be natural with practice and doing things in life. It's where we really actively learn that in the service retreat here. So a lot of that, the naturalness is partly allowing things to be the way they are. Everything I've been saying needs some trust that conditions are what arises and it's not in our hands. That we need some trust there, because otherwise we'll be just, in a way, all the time captured by fears and anxieties about what might be and what might happen. And they're very strong, these fears and anxieties. And they create the story of what I want and what needs to happen and what isn't happening, and that it should be something else. So we do need some trust. It's the kind of choice we have of no resistance. And it is part of the practice. Choose no resistance. Because then the truth is more accessible for us. It's easier to connect with the truth with intimacy without resistance. If we put pressure of karma that things have to be in a certain way, then that creates the resistance and the intimate. It's more difficult to experience intimacy because there's a kind of filter. Things have to be in a certain way. So the naturalness is a key here. The kind of endless spacious awareness of Mahamudra or Tibetan Vipassana, if you like. It's the name of it is called Natural Great Perfection. Natural Great Perfection. And it's not that we can, you know, we have to pay attention to that. It's something there natural. When one of the greatest non-dual teachers of the 20th century is Nisargadatta Maharaj, I think, you know, if you ever want a book, the book, I think, on non-dual liberating insight, it's I Am That, Anihuze, and its dialogues with Nisargadatta Maharaj. And what's Nisargadatta mean? Mr. Natural. It's just so, it's not the great guru in the sky, it's Mr. Natural. It's important. What we're doing here is natural. We're reconnecting to places that we've forgotten, which is the sources that that run our life. So karma may be unpleasant. It's not that it's necessary. The pressure may be difficult. The pressure creating stories, the pressure of the wheels turning. We wish they wouldn't, or we wish they would get. We could get off the wheel. We wish. I think there was a. If I remember, in 1991. When I spent a year in Varanasi with my family and with three girls and Rachel, and we were due to go back, and we were waiting in Varanasi railway station for the train, and there was some slogan of Indian railways about karma there somewhere on the railway. I don't remember what the slogan was, but I do remember we were sitting there waiting for the train for 15 hours with small girls, you know, kind of Israeli, English, three girls aged 11, 13 and 15 who didn't really want to use the Indian toilets. 15 hours we were waiting for the train, and there was a message about karma somewhere at the back. So all of that does lead to equanimity, to a steadiness, to being the big view. And just a mention of something we said before that I want to just raise again. The near enemy of equanimity, of upekkha. All the four Brahma Viharas have a near enemy, meaning something that looks like them but it's not really the thing itself. The near enemy of compassion, for example, is pity in English. In Hebrew, the near enemy of compassion, of chemla, would be rachamim. In English, pity. That it's looks a bit like compassion, but it's not. It's a bit contaminated, mazuham, with self. I can be compassionate as long as I'm up here and there. So the near enemy of equanimity is indifference, adishut. And it looks quite similar. And it shuts doors rather than opening them. And sometimes we need it. We talked quite a bit about this, that it's all right to have boundaries. It's not a problem to have boundaries as long as we have a sense that boundaries are workable. We can move them. We don't need to be stuck with them our whole life. And but adishut, we should just know that it's there, that it looks a bit like equanimity, but it's more closed. It's keeping out problems or issues. And therefore, we win peace sometimes, but it's a little bit of a false peace. It's a peace from shutting the door. Not a peace from being in the middle of the storm and be peaceful. Right in the middle of things. That's real equanimity. More difficult, of course. And we can feel it. It's okay to say, you know, now, we talked about this before, now I do need protection. Like if we're on a retreat and we feel very sensitive. And then, yes, when we leave the retreat, take it slowly. You can say, no, I should be equanimous in the middle of, go straight to Rehob Dizengoff and stand right in the middle of there. Wait a minute, you don't have to. It's okay to be a little bit adishut. Is sometimes really fine and needed. It's okay, it's not that it's a problem, but we should just know it. And slowly, slowly we don't need it. And but sometimes we do and it's okay. For example, some pain, some kinds of pain, we just say, not now. Thank you very much. I once had I used to teach old people from the kibbutzim who were all above 70, and some of them much older. And this was in the Moshav Amka near Klil. And there was one guy there that came through the Shoah. He had a number on his arm. And he said, and he was so much in love with the Dharma. He loved the meditation. He was just went right in it. And I think partly because of the early pain was so strong that he kind of really went into the practice. And he said, but there's one thing I will not bring into my practice at all. And that's my experience in the Shoah. That's out of the whole. You say tchum, right? Extraterritorial. And that's wisdom. That's not a problem. The last thing you want to say to that person, well, you have to deal with your pain. Do vipassana on your experiences in the Shoah when you were a child. No. Absolutely not. We need to be, use wisdom here. And not to be natural with it. So, final few words. I just want to raise another issue that came up in the groups, and it's very, I think all of us may be thinking about it, and it's an issue which we really need to think about, which is, if I am equanimous, balanced, steady and trusting, isn't it accepting those things that are unacceptable, like injustice in the world? How can I go out and make a difference in the world from equanimity if I'm saying, that's the way things are, it's all karma? The Indians are very good at that. The Indians take it too far. And people complain a lot about Indians. Oh, they're just sitting around, you know, believing in karma, and they could change their life. They could do better. It's the Westerners that say that. But it's true in a way that there is an issue there. You have to be careful. You have to know what's going on. And not see acceptance as a source of paralysis, of shituk. Instead of that, seeing trust and equanimity as a wisdom that helps us to make change in the world. Because if we want to make change in the world from resistance, anxiety, anger, and conflict, we have to be really careful that we're not part of the problem. Even in the name of the sickness of injustice. And trust and equanimity is a place of deep steadiness that actually allows us to go out in the world more effectively, not exhausted by Sisyphi work against the whole catastrophe. It actually helps us a lot to go out in the world and make change. There's a very nice text when the Buddha talked about this. He said, you can talk to people and engage with people if they are, even if they have different views from you, or if sometimes they're very emotional or angry or upset, you can engage with them. But if they're very, very emotional, angry, upset, and have very, very strong views and totally feel they're right, you cannot. It's just not going to work. And then your equanimity is what works. Equanimity is a power that radiates a different way of being. And I've noticed this a lot in the kind of middle of the storm. The years we went to work with Palestinians and Israelis and bringing Palestinians and Israelis together for years, nearly every month we went to the occupied territories with groups of Israelis and worked weekends with Palestinians. And very often things were potentially very stormy and very sort of the ground was unstable. And a few times we had, you know, a lot of reactivity. Palestinians that have lost close family members, Israelis similar, soldiers meeting, you know, people serving in the IDF, meeting Palestinians who may be throwing stones. They didn't know necessarily that, but there was... But something that the Palestinian facilitator and myself as a facilitator, we really worked on is to keep generating equanimity and trust and kind of an energy of healing and trust and kindness and not trying to manipulate too much. And again we saw the way that sort of collapsed the energy of conflict. It just collapsed it. Like in India, if you want a snake, like a cobra, not to bite you, you go around to the back of the snake and you pull its tail. And all the aggression goes, snake doesn't do anything. It's like equanimity can pull out the aggression from situations and can be quite effective. Trust is a way of making change in the world, or a basis. So I think that's what I'll finish with that right now. Let's take a couple of minutes. So walking meditation for 20 minutes or so, and then there'll be metta practice.